doing chapter 3, text 18, correct? Text. Naiva tasya kritain arto, na kritaine hakashchana. Kashchid arta vyaparshayaha. Word for word, na. Never. Eva, certainly. Tasya, his. Kritena, by discharge of duty. Artaha, purpose. Na, nor. Akritena, without discharge of duty. Iha, in this world. Kashchana, whatever. Na, never. Cha, and. Asya, of him. Sarvabhuteshu, among all living beings. Kashchit, any. Artha, purpose. Vyapashrayaha, taking shelter of. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Key. A self-realized man has no purpose to fulfill in the discharge of his prescribed duties, nor has he any reason not to perform such work, nor has he any need to depend on any other living being. Purport. A self-realized man is no longer obliged to perform any prescribed duty, save and except activities in Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is not inactivity either, as will be explained in the following verses. A Krishna conscious man does not take shelter of any person, man or demigod. Whatever he does in Krishna consciousness is sufficient in the discharge of his obligation. Okay, I'll read the translation one more time. A self-realized man has no purpose to fulfill in the discharge of his prescribed duties, nor has he any reason not to perform such work, nor has he any need to depend on any other living being. So, we're in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, so things are starting to heat up. Krishna's given the summary in chapter 2, and setting of the scene was in chapter 1. And now we're going into Karma Yoga. And Krishna is pointing out here to Arjuna that a person who is self-realized, someone who's self-realized is free from the obligatory duties. So a person who's in material life, who is in any normal activity life, they're doing their job, they're working for family, they're raising children, they're looking after themselves. Of course, nowadays there's a lot more looking after ourselves. We don't have so much of a community that was in this culture that's in Bhagavad Gita, where you have family and things. Now we even go away from that. But this is a person who is free from duty. This is a person who is practicing self-realization or perfected in self-realization. What do we do with this? Too quiet? Or? We have a tendency nowadays to renounce everything. We renounce our family, we renounce our obligations to them, we renounce our partners, we renounce our friends, and we just do what we want to do. This verse isn't really describing that kind of living. It's talking about there's only really a certain person who can abandon such obligations in the Vedic Puranic text in the ancient Eastern livelihood. That person has to be actually thinking about self-realization and doing things that are spiritual, because if you're not doing things that are spiritual, then you have to follow the material laws. It's saying that if you don't want to do Krishna consciousness, if you don't want to do self-realization, then you actually have to do yajna to the demigods. Because otherwise you're stealing the very material that you're using to enjoy. Everything in this world is not like you go to the shop you don't just see people giving out free food and they charge you for it. There's some kind of business, some kind of interaction there. Similarly, this world like isn't just given to us to do whatever we want with it. And you see what's happening now. We have such bad environmental problems because we're treating this place like we run it and we own it. And we're just taking, we're not giving back. And now we're finally realizing, at least on the gross sense, we actually have to give something back. So the point is that God and his representatives have given us a planet, have given us our air to breathe and our land to live on and our food to eat. So we have to reciprocate some way. So this is saying you can reciprocate by trying to understand the goal of life and understanding who we are as a person. But otherwise, it's not saying here, but it's kind of suggested and later mentioned. Otherwise, you have to do the needful. You have to show some thanks. You know, in Christianity, we say our grace, and in the Christian tradition, before we eat, we also say our grace with the prasadam prayers. We thank Krishna for helping us to have something to control our senses with. So I think, is it in this chapter later, or before? Or is it the fifth chapter, Madhu, where they start talking about yajna? Later in the Bhagavad Gita we'll find that it must just be before. Oh. Yeah, so all living bodies subsist on food grains, which are produced from rains. Rains are produced by performance of yajna, sacrifice, and yajna is born of prescribed duties. So just before this text has come, Krishna is talking about sacrifices and food. In the Vedic concept, they used to offer to the gods via fire sacrifice. They would chant them these mantras in Sanskrit, like we've chanted now, and they would offer oblations. You know, it was expensive in one sense, but it wasn't like, you know, you weren't throwing bits of gold and houses in there, but you were showing some appreciation to the gods, or God, depending which way you want to do it. And that kind of makes up for the fact that you're using their resources. Like even if your friend gives you something for free, just out of friendship, you at least say thank you. Is it right? If you don't say thank you, if you just take something from your friend and you don't thank him or don't even indicate to him that you've taken it, then it's thievery. I was talking with my... this is good. Yeah, I'll read that soon. Text 10. Okay. I was talking to my brother one day. It was him or me, I can't remember who, but one of us borrowed $10 from the other brother. We took it from his... One of us, say I just did, I took it from his wallet and I gave him a text message. I said, hey, I took $10 from your wallet. And he didn't even expect me to pay it back. He said, no worries. But I was talking with him later. I said, imagine if I had have taken that $10 from you and not asked and you had have found out. And he said, we wouldn't be brothers anymore. Like if I had stole from him, then the relationship has been compromised. And all I had to do was say, hey, I took $10 from him. And I didn't even have to give him anything. I just had to acknowledge the fact that it was his and that I took it and that it was done in a loving mood. So similarly, we just really, I mean, the essence of sacrifice is that you're acknowledging that you've taken something. And you may not necessarily have the ability to give anything back, but at least you're acknowledging that. So, I mean, we do that. We chant Hare Krishna. We understand that Krishna is God in our concept and that he's given us everything. So we thank him. You just at least acknowledge it. So you have this whole Vedic ritual that they used to have with all mantras and yantras and tantras and all. But the essence of it is that you're thanking someone and you're appreciating what they're giving to you. Like bhakti is, some people translate bhakti as attitude and gratitude. So we're practicing bhakti yoga. Practicing the yoga, the connection. Yoga means connection. Practicing the connection between being grateful and devotional, thanking actually. That's our connection to Krishna. That's our God connection. So similarly, if you're going to do something with material objects, then you have to make that sacrifice. And you don't have to maybe do a yajna, but you have to do some kind of yajna, whether it's Vedic or not. Like we do sankirtan, we chant, and we spread that because it's a spiritual sound vibration. So we're giving something because we've received so much. But you at least, even if you're not giving something, you at least acknowledge that you've taken something. So Madhu found a verse, I'm going to read it. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods, along with sacrifices for Vishnu, and blessed them by saying, "Be thou happy by this yajna sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation." This is 3:10. Ooh, text 9. Yeah, work done, so this is text 9, work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu, Vishnu's God, has to be performed. Otherwise, work causes bondage in this material world. Therefore, O son of Kunti, perform your prescribed duties for his satisfaction, and in that way, you will always remain free from bondage. So, I mean, in text 10, it's saying, like, actually, I mean, once you acknowledge someone and you thank them, then they're going to be more happy to give you something. So if you acknowledge God and his representatives, the demigods, it's saying, then they will give you more. They'll be pleased to give you something. I mean, how much are you more obliged to a friend who's thankful compared to a friend who's not thankful? Like, if you just give something to your friend and he just never says anything about it, you're just going to stop wanting to give him things. You'll maybe give him something, but if your friend is always thanking you, you know, makes you a nice card or whatever, you always remember this person. Just that gratitude. And then, and this is ultimately what I'm going to address as well with this, in regards to this verse. In the ninth text, it's saying material things, if you don't do yajna, then the material things cause bondage. And that was the point I was making. If you're not doing spiritual things, then the material things you do will cause bondage. So you have to alleviate that some way, which the easiest way is to acknowledge where it's coming from. And then that ultimately will bring you closer to God and will bring you closer to spirituality. But someone who is a self-realized man, as it says in text 18, they don't really have to do duties. Because they've understood that life is spiritual and that material is a temporary thing. Like, everything we do is transitory. You have a car, the car breaks down. So you can't just live for your car because, I mean, you can keep rebuilding it and recreating it, but eventually every piece in it is going to die out and be destroyed. Similarly, we have our childhood, and then we have our youth, and then we have our old age. And everything's taken, actually. And everyone is really, really scared of death because they've been accruing things all their life, hoping to permanently live in this world, knowing that they can't, that it's going to be taken. So people who are spiritually inclined, they're not afraid of death because they have more of an awareness of it and they don't see it as the end of everything. But people who don't have that spiritual nature, they get very scared because they think of all the bad things they've done and they think, okay, well, I didn't achieve happiness and I'm going to die now and it's all over and I've got no other chance and this is it. And it's really daunting. But as we see in this verse, even all these material things, they're not really the essence of life. Because otherwise, it ultimately means that someone is going to perfect life more than another just based on what they have materially. But it doesn't work. I mean, name one rich person who's conquered death or conquered disease. They got better cures, but you can't buy a day back. You can't stop. Prabhupada always gives that example of a man who's very rich trying to buy 4 more days or something from the doctor. I just want a few more days to just consolidate everything I've done. But no, there's no waiting at that time. You don't have any choice. You don't have any choice whether it's tomorrow or whether it's, you know, whether it's painful, whether it's quick. This is not up to you. Of course, there's some kind of karmic thing you can work towards, but honestly, you have to be ready for it, and that means you have to have some kind of spiritual awareness. You can't just be caught up in material things. So the spiritually realized person, as it's saying here, they don't have an obligation to do material things. Their obligation is to be spiritually realized. And that in itself is doing things for others, because honestly, like, you have to do something with your life. You can't just... Krishna condemns Arjuna for deciding to do nothing. So this is worse than action. Like, you have to do something. You have to help people somehow. You either have a job and you help in the economy, or you pay taxes and you're helping someone materially, or you can do something more serious and you can do something spiritual and you can help people's souls. And this ultimately is good, because you still get to save yourself. I mean, you don't lose anything from doing it. Honestly, how many of you feel like you lost something turning towards the spiritual path? You can be honest. You can say you lost something. I mean, you lose a lot of... Sometimes you lose material things. Sometimes you just have to give them up temporarily. But I've seen mostly they come back, actually. I feel like I'm 16 again, because I have everything I had when I was 16, and I've got to now think about it through a spiritual perspective. Because I haven't lost anything since I've started spiritual life. I've only gained things. So... when you do spiritual life, you have everything you need. So once you have everything, and it's as it says, you fill the pot of nectar, and what overflows, then you can distribute that. So what you can't take in yourself, you can give to others, and that ultimately helps you. But the point is, you have to do something for people. You can't just be selfish, because you'll have a selfish end. You'll be on your own and lonely. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to go and conquer the world and preach boldly or you know, do anything outrageous, but you should at least make yourself spiritual, so then your vibration within this whole atmosphere is beneficial to everyone else. At least do that, because otherwise if you don't do something, if you don't make your own aura and your own self beneficial to others, then you're just going to create, when you got someone who's like the death of the party or the life drainer, they're there and they're just feeding on depression and hate and all these bad things, and they're just draining it from you, and you put a smile and they just love to turn your smile into a frown and just like melt it off your face. So we don't have to be like this. This is horrible. Why not just make everything we do make people happy, make people inquisitive, make people love life, or at least see the truth? Because sometimes spiritual life makes you kind of see the material life as really kind of bland and boring and sad. But at least you see something. At least you get some truth. But yeah, why do we have to just drain out of people? Why do we expect that everyone else in this world is there to please us, and we're just gonna like take and just drain it from them? This is really selfish, and we get like this actually. Like someone once told me the other side of the false ego is where you think you're horrible and useless and worthless, and you just like loathe yourself entirely. Because we always think, when we talk about ego, we always think like, I am the macho man, I am God, I am the creator, I am strong. But sometimes it's like, no, I need sympathy. Just feed me sympathy. But this is ignorance. This is really like really selfish. And everyone kind of falls into this trap at one point in their life or another. They just think they deserve all the attention of the world, that everything is designed for their pleasure. But ultimately, if you want that pleasure, if you want some kind of happiness, and you want people to appreciate you, you've got to just put out something nice. I mean, people have struggles, of course. You can't tell someone not to be sad because life's tough. But you can still, like, you know, at least do something about yourself. That helps people. You can just spiritual material, but spiritual is obviously better because it's permanent. Material is going to be temporary, so you can do temporary help. But if you do spiritual, you will affect people permanently. The effect will go on, and it will be counted. So if you do some material help, if you give some people some money, some starving children, I'm not saying you don't, but if you do, the benefit will be they will fill their stomach, and then the benefit will go. If you help someone spiritually, you can still feed their stomach. Especially, we do prasadam distribution, sanctified food. Feed someone, fill their stomach, and they get spiritual benefit. So the spiritual benefit goes on forever. When people, we talk about reincarnation, but there's something that remains, and the soul remains. Krishna says that in the second chapter and many other places in the Bhagavad Gita. The soul remains, and that also means his spiritual credit. The soul's realizing itself again, coming back to its true essence, that remains. And Krishna says, 15:15, Bhagavad Gita, he says, he gives knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So he makes us forget things that... He makes us forget things actually that stop us from enjoying this world, because if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, we'll get bored. But also he makes us forget things that stop us from progressing on the spiritual path. And then he gives us knowledge. He will give us the knowledge we need, and he will give us the remembrance we need. He will maintain these different factors to bring us to the highest awareness. So, I mean, ultimately, you cannot go about life just taking from people. You have to do something. But as this verse is saying, the higher thing is to do something spiritual. And then you help yourself and you help others. And you ultimately see this world for what it is. And you see the transits that go on temporarily and constantly at the same time. And you decide to do something a little bit higher for yourself and for others. And yeah, I mean, and it starts with Bhagavad Gita. I know, like, if you want to know who you are, start with Bhagavad Gita. It starts off, it tells you you're eternal, you're individual, you're not the body, you're a soul. The body is actually a vehicle, and you're going from life to life. And the material world is temporary happiness and distress. It says it's a real, like, we read this a lot, and we forget how seriously important this is. People practice religion for a long time, for years, and they don't even come to the basic point. The second chapter, the second instruction that Krishna gives Arjuna, you know, you're the soul and you're going from body to body. Or the first instruction he gives, you know, you're eternal and you're individual. People don't get this stuff. This is the first thing you get through. People forget the first chapter is this setting the scene, that should call it the introduction, really. But as soon as Krishna starts instructing Arjuna from the very word of go, it's really deep knowledge, and it's really, really simple at the same time. It's not like you don't have to be a rocket scientist. The only thing that you find difficulty with it is you just haven't heard this before, because it just doesn't... It's really simple knowledge, but it's not found anywhere. So when it comes for the first time, it shocks you. You're just like, what is this? This is obscene. But it's quite basic. Like, this body is a vehicle. It's not something... Because if you're the body, you know, we say this is my hand and this is my arm and this is my... Who are you? I'm the body. No, this is my body. It belongs to me. There is some awareness within, and we feel that, and we understand that. When you lose your hand, you don't lose a piece of yourself. You lose a hand. You lose a piece of the instrument you have. And when your body collapses, you don't finish. The brain is not all that's going on here. Scientists try to really figure it all out and say it's all like electromagnetic pulses or whatever. That's incorrect. But, you know, they try to bring it to the brain and say this and that, but they still don't know why there's some kind of source of energy coming from the heart. Prabhupada says this, you know, there's an awareness that there's an energy there, but no one really knows what it is. And it's because we believe that's where the soul resides, and the soul is not our soul, like it's my hand. The soul is me. I am the soul, and this is my body, not I am the body and this is my soul. We always mix it around. This is a seriously important thing, and it's just the first thing that comes into your head when you read Bhagavad Gita. And not only is Krishna saying it simply, but Srila Prabhupada is also elaborating on it and making sure we really get the point. And this, anyway, so if you see, like, devotees really kind of, some people think they're fleeing the world, but they kind of understand that the world is not worth getting caught up in. And that's what this verse is really pointing towards. You don't really have to get caught up in it. Or if you are in the world, then you realize that, why over-endeavor? Why do too many things? Why not just do the basic things I need? Because honestly, what do we need to survive? Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And some of these things even die down. You don't need much more than that. You don't, like, we grab so much more. We max out our credit cards and put ourselves into heaps of debt just to get things, little trinkets that we don't need. I mean, if you got some money, get a Bhagavad Gita. Really? the best investment you'll get. I mean, it's you know, you talk about turnover, or when you do a business transaction, you put a dollar in, how much do you get back? Do you get $2, do you get $3? You put some money into Bhagavad Gita, you don't get any money back, you just get permanent satisfaction. And it's up to you how much, you know, you get out what you put in. If you really want to know, then the Bhagavad Gita reciprocates. People often say that you pick up the Bhagavad Gita and you read something you've never read before. I mean, it's got a few pages. It's got, like, 800 pages or something. But I've read it a few times and it's still a good read. And I know someone who's read, he's 26 years old, he's read it 60 times. 60 times, and, you know, purports and all. And you could say, is he obsessive? No, he's a pretty intelligent, down-to-earth guy. But there's something new every time. Because this is the spiritual science, and it's giving you spiritual awareness, and it's a spiritual book. It doesn't exist on, you know, it's made of material paper and I can tear it to pieces, but the knowledge that's within it is spiritual, which means it's eternal and it's got all variety. It means it's always changing. Even just reading this verse, it's like you could read this and you can read it again and you'll come up with something new. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, I mean, it was the Bhagavatam, not the same book, but Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati emphasized by doing a month or 3 months on one verse. He just spoke on the first verse of Bhagavatam over and over and over again, because you can always churn out something new. So we have something that's like giving unlimited reciprocation. And so why do we waste so much time with everything else? Why don't we just really, like, I mean, it doesn't mean you have to have the book glued to your nose every day. You have to contemplate it too. I mean, how many people read this whole thing and then forget to contemplate it in their life? You know, Krishna gives you so many tools in this book that you can think in your day-to-day life that make you realize the spiritual truth. He doesn't just. I mean, this is God speaking according to our belief. God is not going to waste words. God's words have to be perfect, which means that everything he said has to be seriously significant, has to really mean something, has to be like totally applicable. When, you know, when the president speaks or someone important, a dignitary speaks, their words have, they're packed with meaning and thought, and you see these old philosophers and you can read and everything's got some worth to it. So God, who is the ultimate philosopher, has to have some serious worth. And if you want to be doubtful and say Krishna's not God, then he's still going to have some worth, because he was such a philosopher that he was considered God, that people considered him an incarnation. So if you don't even want to believe that it's God, then you still have to realize that this has got some serious worth, some serious value. And these words are life changing. Once you go, I mean, that's what you have to fear, is that if you actually want to give these words some impact in your life will totally change. And you got to be ready for that. It's never going to be the same. you can't hide from it after that. Like, once you have knowledge, you know, when you know something, you just can't do things the same anymore. I used to work, and once you know the law of the safety regulations or whatever, you just can't break it anymore. It's just stuck on you. So once you know this knowledge about life, you'll filter life through this in a good way. Like you get a good water filter, it takes out the good minerals and takes out the bad minerals and gives you the good ones, and ionizes your water and charges it. So this is what this is doing. It's taking out all the filth in life. It's casting it aside and it's giving you vision of what it looks like, and then it's showing you what's actually really important. And so you grab onto that, and that's so you turn your life into the essence of it. We use the example, you churn butter, you boil down butter, and you get ghee, which is the healthy essential aspect of the butter. And butter, we know, is fatty and bad for your body and gross for a lot of people. I don't always agree, but ghee is something, it's so pure that the older it is, the better it is. You can, like, they found it in the Egyptian tombs. They find ghee in the Egyptian tombs, and it's still good. You can still put it on your khichdi in the morning. It's still edible. This is what we're doing with life. We're churning and burning out all the things that are useless, and we're finding the essential keys of life. And then we're looking back at everything else, and we can see it for what it really is. This is duty on its own. You don't have to perform other prescribed duties if you're really putting your life towards this. And that's what this verse is indicating. What do you need all this other useless junk for if you have the essence? And that's been exemplified by how a lot of our acharyas, like the six Goswamis. Is there a picture? Six Goswamis used to live under trees, and they weren't mad. They were highly intelligent. There's universities in Calcutta now studying Jiva Goswami's Satsandarbhas, and they got a whole university dedicated to this one person's books, and he was living under a tree. A different tree every night, not just the same tree. He didn't find a tree he really liked. He just picked a tree and slept there because he didn't need anything. Knowledge is something you can't steal unless you hit someone really hard in the head. It's a wealth you can share and you still keep. And it's something, so spiritual knowledge especially, because it's not just how to fix your radiator in your car, it's how to save yourself from material frustration and how to really get the best out of life. You can't trade that. But at the same time, you can give it to everyone and you still keep it. I don't know how long this class is supposed to go on for, so I'm going to ask questions and comments. Madam. Oh, by Burujan Prabhu. I haven't read much of it, but I did his audio Bhakti Shastra. There you go. Mm-hmm. Yep. Serious stuff here. I mean, that's the thing. Like we talk about Bhagavad Gita, and we say it's like the basics of philosophy, but this is really advanced philosophy. It's not like your everyday stuff. It's basic because it's you need it. It's the fundamental things, like not the body and these things, but it's quite serious. And you see, like you can, like I said, you can read it so many times. You could write some pretty serious things about the Bhagavad Gita, and you see what Prabhupada has churned out of it. But you were looking for the yoga ladder, were you? Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me think, try not to speculate. I mean, Prabhupada, like throughout, because the Bhagavad Gita ultimately comes to a conclusion in the 12th chapter about that bhakti is the process. So you can see that he kind of imbibes all the yoga levels with bhakti. So when you kind of, bhakti itself is independent, you can have karma yoga. And you see it's really trendy. People call it karma yoga and they're just talking about, you know, being healthy actually and doing yoga for their body. Your action and connection, so connecting through action. And Prabhupada just throws bhakti in all of it, you know, devotion, you're connecting through devotion, so acting in devotion, thinking in devotion, you know, buddhi yoga and yoga of intelligence, he translates to bhakti. Jnana yoga, he'll separate if it's needed to explain the point, but ultimately knowledge, yoga of knowledge is knowledge of Krishna. So ultimately, whether you're acting or reading or thinking or whatever, bhakti is something higher that you could put in anything. If you're doing karma yoga on its own, without the bhakti aspect, then it would be a lower. Because then karma yoga is Vedic sacrifice, yajna, and then jnana yoga is Upanishad and this kind of path. So without the bhakti, then you have gradation. But if you have bhakti in anything, then you can't say that someone who's digging for Krishna and someone who's studying for Krishna, like one's better than the other. It really depends on their meditation. Of course, we measure a devotee by his faith and his knowledge. So you have to also be careful not to just become illiterate and in your spiritual knowledge and just dismiss it altogether. Does that help? Or does that just make it more confusing? And I found I read it the first time, it was like I was being introduced to it. And then the set, because actually all the concepts that come up at the end are in the beginning as well. The second time I read it, I got a pen and paper and I was kind of serious about it. And then it made sense. The first time was kind of like, just like, whew. I mean, you can read it slower. I was kind of really trying to read it because I wanted to read it, prove myself. But you can read it slower and you can really absorb it, but ultimately, yeah, it's worth reading a lot of times. Even Arjuna, in the Mahabharata, he actually asked Krishna to re-explain the Bhagavad Gita because he forgot it, he said. And he wanted a repeat. And then if you read the 11th canto, you have the Uddhava Gita, which is like Bhagavad Gita part 2. It's just like the same thing, but elaborated even more. And, you know, although there's whole chapters that are like virtually exactly the same as the Bhagavad Gita, but there's a few more points or a few different points. So there's a lot, yeah. The hearing process is our first process, and then we have the kirtan. But hearing is also reading, then you have your kirtan, then you can speak, you can sing the glories, and then from that you'll remember it and you won't forget it. You need to read it. If you like to read, then why not? Some people like to read stories, but we've got plenty of stories too. Yeah. So. Okay, Granthaj Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki.
Super light, hè? Swami Domine.
Amen.